Well, good evening and welcome. I'm Angela Fitzpatrick and Maestro Mester, and I thank you for coming this evening. And during our pre-concert conversation, we will discuss the program. The music we will be listening to is a delightful combination of the familiar and the new, the absolute and programmatic genres, two very different historical and cultural eras, and a rarely performed work for vocal soloist and orchestra. It's a great deal to get excited about.
Well, it doesn't get more Russian than Petrushka. It doesn't get more French than Scheherazade. And it doesn't get more Haydn than the Haydn. The Haydn is such an incredible example of his wit and the wit that covers up his erudition and his great sense of style. But he makes it seem innocent and kind of almost simple-minded, and that's why you can't sell tickets to an all Haydn program, because it's not sexy like Mozart. And musicians just love playing Haydn because they get all the jokes. For example, in the second movement, there's a section where the strings just play the same note over and over and over again until it disappears, followed by gigantic fortissimo. And all his jokes are musically valuable. They're not just jokes that you throw in just to make ha-ha-ha, but each of the jokes is can be explained for the musical reasons and the form of the piece. So I think that Haydn is just such an incredibly great composer. He wrote this piece for an orchestra of 40 violins and 10 double basses. And so when you think, you know, you've got to play Haydn with small groups, he only had 25 musicians in Esterhaz. Composers of his time, whenever they were presented with a very large orchestra, they were in ecstasy because, you know, I guess they're more macho that way if they got more musicians on stage. The problem is when you do it with lots of string players, then the balances suffer. And back in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, particularly in Germany, they used these gigantic orchestras to play Mozart symphonies and Beethoven symphonies. They had to double or triple the woodwinds in order to balance. And for myself, whenever I can, I do Beethoven symphonies with the chamber orchestra, which is what brings out the inner voices. Brahms, believe it or not, in his first symphony, insisted that he did not want more than 10 first violins. And when you hear Brahms these days, you hear it like chocolate malted, you know. But indeed, they sound really great when you have a very small group of strings, just the way he asked for it. So anyway, that's just little things that you can use at the next cocktail party.
Now, how did Haydn appear on a program that's supposed to talk about Paris?
Paris? What about Paris? It's a nice place.
Oh, I know, I guess.
He wrote 6 symphonies for Paris. Paris loved his music, and also London loved his music. And publishers would publish his music as soon as it was dry on his scores, because he was such a superstar. And so that's about it in terms of Paris. I'm sure you can add tons of things to the Paris thing.
Oh, since we were in this Music Makes the City theme this year,
that's true.
All of the pieces are supposed to have some relationship to the city designated. And obviously, Ravel is French. That was an obvious one.
And that's why we stuck the Haydn in there, because it's a Paris symphony. And I think Music Makes the City had not only to do with just the fact that there was a connection somehow in the performance or something, but it has to do more with the fact that the cities that we featured actually supported the music in a way that other cities did not. And so Paris was the fermenting vat for incredible amount of music. And of course, with the ballet in Paris, Stravinsky and Diaghilev just did incredible things. And this Petrushka is basically the very first really Russian piece. I think Firebird was not really that Russian, but this is Russian in the sense that, first of all, he uses Russian tunes, and also it was the first time that he used individual players. You're going to hear a flute and a trumpet and a tuba and the clarinet and the snare drum, all kind of with solo moments.
Before we get to Stravinsky, do tell them about the Ravel, because it is one of your favorites. The Ravel?
Well, because for me, Ravel is one of the perfect pieces ever written. And we did it once here about 1974. And what happened is that, if you want to hear a weird story, do you know about P.D.Q. Bach?
Yes.
Okay, so Peter Schickley and I are very close friends. And he was one of the he did testimony on my behalf when I went to have my examination by the it's not the police, it's the immigration authorities, when I was about to get my naturalization. And as we were driving down the West Side Highway, he said, you know, there's going to be an amalgamation, there's going to be a fusion of rock music and concert music, the same way that many centuries ago Bach combined dance forms and concert music. And so Peter Schickley and two of his colleagues wrote the music for the infamous, or maybe famous, O Calcutta. Do you remember that was a play that had nudity and so on? First play on Broadway that had that. Of course, if you wanted to see nudity, otherwise you had to go to New Jersey, because you couldn't see it in New York for a long time. And so I asked Mayor Farnsley, how can I get money together to commission these three musicians who wrote the music for Calcutta and performed in the pit as the trio that wrote the music? So he helped me find some money, and when we premiered it, on the same program was the Ravel. Now, the pieces written for this trio, we have the record, you can probably still get it, Three Views from the Open Window. The Open Window is the name of the group. And unfortunately, one of the pieces used a tape as background of a couple engaged in amorous exchanges. And when the orchestra found out that this subliminal thing was being played in the background, 40% of them decided they wouldn't play the concert. Little did they know that the Ravel was far sexier. When you read the poem, you can see, especially the first movement is sexy in a very weird way, because when it gets to assassins and death and blood, it's basically an aphrodisiac for the person who is telling the story. And the big climax in the first movement of the Ravel goes with the words, I want to see roses and I want to see blood. And I want to see someone die of love and of hate. So, you know, and then there's this fantastic sound from the orchestra, which is the greatest. So anyway, I love this piece. And Susan Platz is a wonderful singer, so you will be happy with her.
Okay. Shall we go now to Petrushka? How many of you have at some time in your life seen the ballet Petrushka? And how many of you have heard the suite from the ballet either live or on discs and so. But you see, we have very few people that know things about Petrushka. So after you leave to get ready for the concert tonight, I will let you know the story of what Petrushka is all about. It's about puppets and a very interesting story, but we won't take your time to hear the story.
It was interesting that Stravinsky, first of all, he was Russian, then he became French, and then he became American. In 1945, he became American. And he studied privately with Rimsky-Korsakov. Mm-hmm. And what I find really interesting is that the three composers that most influenced Stravinsky were Rimsky-Korsakov, Tchaikovsky, and Debussy. And so that I find really fascinating. And of course, Debussy and Ravel have surface similarities, so I guess that binds the program together.
But probably one of the most fascinating things about Stravinsky is that how in his lifetime he was able to change from one form to another form of writing, right, just as smoothly as if he continued writing in the same style all the time. Each new genre that he took on was really quite remarkable.
Well, but you think about most of the composers. I mean, Haydn changed unbelievably his style, and he wrote in many different styles, as did Mozart. Mozart wrote the best Italian operas, and he wrote the best German Singspiels, and he wrote French music, and you know, what would have happened if there had been modern medicine to save Mozart from an early death? Can you imagine what he would have been writing? So Beethoven, I mean, you can't compare Opus 1 of Beethoven with Opus 135, and Brahms too. So all the great composers changed. That's the other ones, the really bad ones, wrote the same piece over and over again. You know, think of, well, I mean, there's tons of really bad ones.
I was going to ask you about the number of soloists that appear in the Petrushka sound. I mean, throughout the orchestra, it's amazing how many solo instruments do some wonderful things.
Well, there's a little tiny violin solo, but there is snare drum, timpani, the first horn has a solo, the trumpet has a gigantic thing, two clarinets have incredible things, the bass clarinet has a duo with the first clarinet, the bassoon has a mournful little thing to play, plus all the three bassoons at the very end play things that sound like the Nutcracker. The second bassoon goes bop, 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 and you expect to hear. So you know, then you have the flute has a gigantic solo. Oboe, not as much.
Mm-hmm. But the wonderful thing about this particular use of solo instruments is the way he uses the first and second clarinets, because it's the first and second clarinets that introduce the theme, Petrushka. So whenever you hear that little melody, you're being right. Identified. He's being identified. And it was very interesting to catch your attention, or for whatever reason, if you take the tones, that you all know the tones of do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, we'll just separate do, mi, sol, and do, and then rock back and forth between sol and do. You've got the genesis of that tune. Plays that in the key of C, and then in the second clarinet plays it in F sharp major,
right,
which is very, very close. And so that when you hear them, and very, very far apart at the same time, when you hear them, it sounds like the first two notes of chopsticks, which, if you remember, are not particularly pleasant, but they resolve to something.
That's why it's very nice to have dissonance, because when you resolve it, it feels so good. Uh-huh. Just like in real life.
So you have this little trumpet-like effect coming out of the clarinets.
Right.
In this bitonality is what they call it. So when you read about bitonality and Stravinsky, that's what it's all about. Uh-huh. And what else do you have to say about Stravinsky?
Well, one of the things is that he wrote several versions of the same piece. And it's not because he had new ideas, but because he needed to renew his... copyright. And that way he was able to continue collecting royalties. So it's interesting because he was human and was not above earning a few extra.
But he made some interesting changes, and that's why it will say on your program it's the 1947 version, because it was originally written in 1913, I believe.
And the original version was a gigantic orchestra, and a lot of the notes have been changed, actually, in order to make it a new piece. Mm-hmm. But you can't hear the changes because they're all hidden in the middle of the primordial mud. And but he did change tons of notes.
And reduce the size of the orchestra.
Yes, so that it was affordable.
Uh-huh. Which made...
What year was it first written?
13, I think, 1913. Yes, he lived to be 89.
That would help.
Yes, he didn't do it posthumously. Do you have any questions before? Because eventually, pretty soon. No, we got 10 whole
we've
minutes.
Got, yes,
unbelievable. Uh-huh. No questions. You know.
What caused the redoing of it in 47? Dissatisfaction or improvement?
No, neither. I think it was important, I think, to have a smaller orchestra, but also because he could renew his copyright. So those two things go hand in hand. And so if he had only stayed with the 1913 version, a lot of orchestras could not have afforded to perform it. Yes? Well, there are several versions of it in which he rebarred certain things. I think the last part, for example, is full of 16th notes and 32nd notes, and there's a lot of clutter visually. And I commissioned somebody to rewrite all those with eighth notes and quarter notes, which is incredibly easy to play. So the difficulties diminish considerably when you play that. Most of the changes that he made for Rite of Spring were spelling changes rather than musical changes.
It wouldn't make much difference in which version.
You couldn't hear it. Yeah. It's just the way that the musicians see the music and interpret the rhythms. Yes?
How did he happen to come to have Rimsky-Korsakov as his teacher? Did I hear you correctly?
Yes. They lived in the same town, and apparently he obviously knew Rimsky-Korsakov, and he somehow applied to Rimsky-Korsakov, who gave him private lessons. That's how, because I don't believe that he was going to be a composer originally, if I'm not mistaken. And
no, he was sent to law school but left.
Right, right. And so he started rather late as a composer, but certainly his genius was not held back.
You know, it's rather interesting to realize that Ravel not only was a very fastidious Parisian, and his poetry that he chose is really quite lovely, but he believed that music should be listened to first emotionally and then intellectually, which was kind of interesting because he was a very reserved and very conservative kind of person.
But his music is extremely human. When you think, there's an opera of his called L'Enfant le Sortilège, which is a one-act opera based on a story by Colette. And it's full of incredibly moving vignettes of inanimate objects coming to life, objects that were mistreated by a bad boy. And all of these come to haunt him at a certain point. And then suddenly he finds himself in a garden outside at night. And the transition between the inanimate objects having each individually come to life is affected by a slide whistle. And so after all of this noise and chaos, all of a sudden you hear, and all of a sudden you're transported to this magic place, and it's just an incredibly beautiful, and of course this piece is as human as it can get. So he may have been reserved, but boy, his imagination was not. And his friend, the poet, whose nom de plume was Tristan Klingsor. His real name was Leon Leclerc. And I have a little quote here. Later in his life, Ravel remarked, speaking of his Scheherazade, "I'm still grateful that I could in these days experience the poetry of Klingsor as intensely as I did. It mobilized and stimulated worlds of sound in me, new possibilities which I was surprised to discover." So you can imagine, his friend actually read the poetry to Ravel, and the poet actually did not think that the first of the songs, which is Asie, that it was possible to set it to music, because it was, according to the poet, very unmusically parsed. And instead, out comes this overwhelmingly beautiful thing. The order, as it's now performed, is Asie, then the enchanted flute, and then the indifferent. But originally, when Ravel conducted this, it was the indifferent one, hold on. I don't want to give you bad information. The order was with the enchanted flute, then the indifferent one, and then Asie. So that's the story with Ravel.
And
when Ravel wrote this, there were poets and there were musicians who were completely mesmerized by the Orient and by Middle East exoticism. And that was all the rage in Paris during that time. And you can see it also in art. But you see this in Ravel, particularly the first song. It's very much like Dali and Tanguy in terms of, it's almost surrealistic when you read the poetry and you realize that behind the poetry is hidden incredible eroticism. I mean, when you think that death is the great the great aphrodisiac. And so then it's called Scheherazade because Scheherazade is telling about all these places that she would like to see. Then the second song is basically seen from inside a harem, as is the third song. And the third song, which Ravel thought should be sung by a man, it is about a man walking by, seen through the windows of a harem. And so that basically is what is interesting about this. You have to think basically of overwhelming perfume, almost of rotting vegetation. How's that to get your imagination going?
On the other hand, too, we should remember that Rimsky-Korsakov was a mentor to Stravinsky, but Ravel was also extremely talented in the field of orchestration. And if I remember correctly, it was he that orchestrated the Mussorgsky pictures at an exhibition.
Correct. And also, he basically wrote much of his music for piano and then orchestrated it. I mean, Tombeau de Couperin. Most of the pieces, Mother Goose, and think about in terms of exoticism, Mother Goose has the Prince of the Pagodas, very Chinesey sounding, and Mahler wrote Das Lied von der Erde based on Chinese poetry. And the third song is all Chinesey kind of music. So that was a kind of almost, I guess you can think of that era as the beginning of decadence, real decadence, in everything, including up to the World War. And then after that, it was not decadence anymore. It was everything was changed, and fun kind of went underground for a while.
No original sin.
I don't know about that. I sin all the time, so nothing original but my sins. Yes.
How does Bolero fit into this?
Well, it's a piece that he hated. He wrote it as an exercise in orchestration, and that's all people asked for. They said, we want to hear Bolero. So he grew to hate that piece a lot, but the audiences love it. And you can always sell out a hall if you put Bolero on it. So whenever you see Bolero on a program, think of the presenters as people of ill repute.
Stravinsky had an interesting thought about Ravel's Bolero. He says, Ravel is the most excellent Swiss watchmaker.
Well, he was, in a sense, everything is minutely put together. So Brahms was also a watchmaker, but he made gigantic watches. Because Brahms took these tiny little germs of melody and created vast buildings. So he was a different kind of watchmaker. So, yes?
Question about the name of the Haydn symphony. What does it mean? And is it
La Poule? It's the hen. And you will hear the hen in the first movement.
So it is a program piece in a sense.
Well, it's a joke.
It's a joke.
Because basically the music stands without knowing it's about a hen. And that's what's nice about Haydn, is that he's not actually depicting a hen, but is using hen as kind of a reason to use certain techniques in the orchestra.
Can somebody hang that name on it a lot later on?
It's very possible. A lot of pieces got their names after, you know, Eroica and a whole bunch of stuff like that.
Well, actually, Haydn didn't. He only named a few of his symphonies. He did name the surprise. He wanted to surprise the ladies at the second movement,
right.
And he did. But the Paris symphonies, I believe.
He may have also named the Farewell Symphony, because it was written specifically as a hint to the prince that the musicians needed to get the night off. And so at the end of the symphony, they turn off their candles and they walk off the stage. And so it's a joke, but musically it's perfect because it's a big diminuendo.
So getting names to symphonies, the composer doesn't always get to do.
No, I'm not sure that Tchaikovsky named it the Pathétique. He died 3-4 days later after he premiered it. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Some people think he committed suicide because his secrets were about ready to get out and would have embarrassed the Tsar. And so some people think that he committed suicide.
I think what his brother gave him that name.
Gave the Pathétique, right. Right. Yeah. So, I'm going to go warm up. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you. Be careful.
Okay. Now you want to know the story of Petrushka. The first scene is set in the Admiralty Square of Old St. Petersburg, and it's during the last 3 days of Carnival in the year 1830. Now, this actually, we know it as Mardi Gras. So when you find that this is set on Shrovetide, that's this 3 days preceding first Ash Wednesday. So this is the big celebration. The music opens with a bright bustle of a fair day. The curtains part, and we see the glittering distraction of the fair are reflected separately and all together in kaleidoscopic rhythms and harmonies from the orchestra. First, there's an organ grinder and a dancing girl, and then a group of revelers reel across the scene. Finally, an organ grinder begins to blow a trumpet, and on the opposite side of the stage, a music box and another dancing girl add their part to the joyous confusion. The crowd grows thicker and much more exuberant. Two drummers appear outside a little puppet theater, and their drums hush the crowd into an expectant silence. The showman, the old wizard, appears. The impression his hocus pocus makes on the gullible populace is reflected in the mysterious mutterings and whirrings of the orchestra. Then the showman plays a foolish little tune on the flute, and the charm is complete. The curtain of the puppet theater rises, and behold three animated puppets, Petrushka, the Moor, and the Ballerina. They do a wild Russian dance to music as garish and frantic and angular as themselves. We're talking Stravinsky now. Then the curtain falls, and the drums rasp again, and there is a change of scene. We now see Petrushka's bare, small, prison-like room. There is a crash. A door opens, and Petrushka is kicked through it, falling flat on the floor. But now we find that, sawdust as he is physically, Petrushka has pathetic glimmerings of a human soul. Petrushka struggles hopelessly in his prison and paws the walls to escape. We hear his frantic gropings and the grotesque arpeggios. That would be like taking Do, Mi, Sol and playing, instead of together, playing them separately. This comes from the piano, and while I'm going to interrupt the story a moment, the piano is used very, very much in this particular piece. It almost sounds like a piano concerto a lot of the time. The original work started out to be a piano concerto until this whole storyline went into Stravinsky's mind, and that's when he cooperated with Diaghilev, the ballet master, and they put together this whole ballet. So if you hear a lot of piano in a symphony orchestra tonight, during this is the reason why. Finally, the trumpets and the cornets and the trombones scream out in rage and in frustration. That won't be hard to find. Suddenly, the door opens, and in trips the tinsely little ballerina. Petrushka loves her, and the orchestra endows her with all the glamour of his imagination, but she will have none of him. The third scene is in the luxurious room of the Black Moor, and the ballerina enters and finds the handsome, brutal Moor very romantic. He makes love to her. The empty-headed banality of the music and of their mutual enchantment makes the tragedy of Petrushka all more heartrending. Suddenly a door opens and Petrushka appears, but he is chased away by the jealous Moor. And the last scene returns to the festive crowd outside the tent. And at the climax of the gaiety, there is a wild thrashing behind the curtain of the puppet theater. And out dashes Petrushka, pursued by the infuriated Moor. The Moor draws his scimitar and kills Petrushka with a vicious blow. With a final grotesque spasm, the puppet dies. There is a consternation among the onlookers. A policeman arrives, but the old woman demonstrates to everyone that, after all, Petrushka was only made of sawdust. The merrymakers disperse in the dusk, and suddenly, as the old wizard is dragging off the sawdust doll, Petrushka's spirit appears above the theater, menacing him, thumbing his nose at his own dissonant theme, the one we talked about, sounds in the orchestra. The wizard drops the sawdust doll in terror and disappears into the darkness. And that's the way the ballet ends. If you ever have the opportunity, it's a magnificent ballet to see. I was very fortunate to have seen that ballet when I was about 10 years old, and I can still have a vision of Messine, the dancer, with his lithe body and how he was crawling the walls and when he appears in that final scene. It's very dramatic. The music is equally exciting. And also another experience that that I did want to share with you is that I was at Saratoga Performing Arts Center the year after Stravinsky died, and we did that season a complete Stravinsky festival and did the ballets and all of the works that were very popular and some that weren't. The local groups got into the act as well, and there was an art exhibit of Mrs. Stravinsky's work because she was an artist. It was just a tremendous celebration to be part of. That score that the maestro was telling you about, The Rite of Spring, was given to me as a gift in its print form, in the original, the ones that were difficult for the score, for the orchestra people to read and to play. Remember, he told you about the revision of the printing of it, but not the sound of it, just the way it was notated. So it's always been a pleasure to talk about Stravinsky and to listen to Stravinsky and to be with you again. I've certainly enjoyed this evening very much and wish you a pleasant evening at the concert. Thank you.